The presenting sponsor of Moon Tower Soccer is FVF Law.
To find out what makes FVF a different kind of injury law firm, you can visit FVF.law.
Hello, friends. Thanks for listening to Moon Tower Soccer. This week, we'll review Austin's big win against the Galaxy. We'll also discuss John Kolmanich's new contract extension and what we think that means. We have a new transfer rumor and what we think that means for the future of our current players. And then we're also going to ask the question, what is Diego Fagundez's legacy in the Austin FC locker room? I'm realizing now I already wrote these notes and we had breaking news between when I wrote this and when we got here. But we're also going to talk about the report from ESPN that Austin FC is going to host the 2025 MLS All-Star Game.
As well as where Danny Pereira might be this week.
So much. My name is Landon Cottam, and I'm joined as always. No, not as always, as sometimes, by Mike Crignola. Mike, thanks for being here, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me, Landon. I'm really excited to fill in for Jeremiah Bentley this week. Just like I told him before the start of the LA Galaxy match, I knew that this would be a really exciting moment, and I certainly wasn't worried about having to have a sad show. Don't check the texts. That's exactly how it went.
Yep, I'm not going to doubt you. All right, before we get into soccer news, we're going to shamelessly self-promote for a moment.
It ain't shameless when you got socks like these, baby.
That's right. So we're going to talk about our Patreon. I talked about how cool the stuff was last week. I think we should take a step back and break down exactly what Patreon is, what our levels are. Patreon is a way for you to support artists, especially in this new media landscape that we live in where everything is segmented, nothing is funded by big corporations or anything. Like it's hard to get paid to make media these days. But part of the beauty of that is you can choose who to support. You can vote with your wallet. Who do you like? Who makes things that give value to your life or to your entertainment time? And so that's what Patreon's for. We have four levels. We're gonna get into that a bit more. But our first level is $2. $2 a month. At that level, it's essentially just a way to buy us a cup of coffee, buy us a beer once a month, and show us your appreciation. The next level, $5 a month. At that level, you also are still showing us your appreciation, and in reward for giving us that little extra money, we're going to give you a set of referee cards. We talked about last week. They're really cool, and I'm really excited to start seeing them out in the wild. And then at the $10 a month level, you'll get the referee cards as well as Moon Tower Soccer socks. I said last week that we have these in hand now. I actually wore the socks to the Austin FC game. A muggy day. It's starting to get hotter here. These socks are great. They feel great. They look great. I love them. I love them. I love them.
Did anyone notice the socks when you wore them?
Nobody noticed the socks. We came into the state. I noticed the times I get recognized the most or stopped by listeners the most is when we get in early and kind of do a lap around the stadium. And we got in a little later. But I'm definitely going to start wearing these two every game and be fishing for compliments. You better believe it, because they look great.
Were you wearing shorts or pants?
I was. Shorts.
Oh, heck yeah. you're so much cooler of an elder millennial than I am. I'm still in that like low ankle sock phase unless I'm wearing pants. And like that's lame. Did you know that? Like it's cool to wear crew length socks now with everything, shorts and all.
I didn't know it, but that's what I do.
Well, good news. You're cool. And everyone listening can be cool also with $10 a month Patreon level to get these sweet socks.
That's right. But so, yeah, it's if you like what we do, if we bring any kind of value to your life, think about the TV subscriptions you pay for. Think about all these different subscriptions you pay for at $5 a month. If we're counting Swoon Tower shows, it's less than a dollar per show. So if you think this hour and 20 minutes once or twice a week that we give you is worth less than a dollar, this is a good level for you. If you think it's worth more than a dollar and you want some cool socks, then you can go up to that $10 level. We do still have our Swoon Tower level available. We realized after last year, we're trying to bring Mike and Steph into the Patreon stuff this last year, and we realized we kind of just biffed it on how we set up the level, and not that many people joined them, I think, because of the pricing. So what we're going to do this time is we'll leave that Swoon Tower level up. If you want to join it and you weren't joined it last year, we'll still send you that patch because we still have some of those. Otherwise, if you want to support Mike and Steph, just join at any level. We're just going to include them in on all of the levels and give them a percentage of any of those levels. So if you like them better than us, A, don't blame you. I like them better than us too. But if you want to support them, just join at any level, and that's going to help them as well.
Yeah. All and right. You know, like, I think one of the things that I like best about this Patreon is that this is how I met Landon Cottom. One of the things that maybe listeners don't know is Landon invited me to his birthday party.
I think we said this last time.
I thought it was to be friends. And then immediately, as soon as I sat down, he said, "So tell me about Patreon." And I realized that it was a business podcast consulting move.
This is a lie. This is a lie.
We did talk about Patreon that day, though. And you were like, is it weird if we have a Patreon and don't do like extra content for patron subscribers? And I said, people want to support your show because they like what you do. And we know that that's true because we've seen that people support the show because they like what you do.
It was true. For the record, that's not why I invited you there. But I think Marcelo, a friend of the show and Moon Tower Soccer Games Master, was the first person to say, hey, y'all should start a Patreon. And I think you jumped on that train as well. But thank you for the push. All right, let's jump into soccer news of the week. The biggest story of the week this week is Austin FC's, can we say dominant? Is this a dominant win over the LA Galaxy?
It's about as dominant as you can win over the Galaxy, I think, this season so far anyway. You know,
everything is relative, right?
We haven't seen them blown out. We haven't seen, we haven't seen ourselves blow a team out. But we ran out to an early lead and then held it, which is also something we haven't seen this year.
We'll qualify it with relatively dominant. But yeah, Austin FC shuts out the Western Conference scoring leaders to get decisive victory. How about that? A decisive victory over the LA Galaxy. And in the week at seventh place in the Western Conference, just a few weeks after we weren't sure we were ever going to win a game.
Yeah, it's been a wild first third of the season here for us so far. And I'm just so excited for what happens next.
So a bit later in the show, we'll go through some of the bigger match events and all of that. But first, let's just talk about some of the biggest storylines of the week. One thing I've seen a lot of discussion online about is Austin's possession in this game and in some of their wins and good performances this year. Austin ended the game with 41% of the possession. And I saw a lot of people kind of suggesting that Austin has been better or played better or won games only when they have less of the ball. And I don't think that quite applies to this game, because if you look at, like, let's say, look at the first, when was the first goal? In the 7th minute. The second goal comes in the 19th minute. At that point, Austin had 56% of the possession. So they were winning the possession battle up until that point. That's when they kind of changed tactics and kind of changed up their game plan and started giving the ball up a bit more. But yeah, it ended up 41-59 in favor of the Galaxy by the end of the game. And I mean, I'll take this as what I hope it means is that Josh Wolf and Austin FC are learning to play a different way when the game calls for it and when it's useful to them. And we've seen them try to change up shapes, change up tactics for midweek games when we're short on players or whatever. We're going to play a back five and see what happens. And it just looks like guys who are used to playing a possession game trying to play a back five, and they don't know what they're doing and they don't know what's going on. And whenever they go up 2-0 and they flip that switch, it looked like the game plan. It looked like they knew what they were doing. Yeah. They were executing against a thing that they were supposed to be doing. And I'm hoping that's not a fluke, that this is growing, this is learning, and that this is them getting better.
The other thing that I thought was apparent in this game is that they weren't necessarily just sitting on a 2-0 lead. There were opportunities for them to like try and add more to the total there, and they were doing it. They were taking those chances when they had them. There were a few, you know, a few more shots after that, really high XG shots, especially from Driussi that end up blocked or that end up just barely missing, you know. And so it's not like the traditional, oh, we've gotten a lead and now we're bunkering kind of mentality that we've seen in the 2023 version of Austin, or even the pre-Driussi 2024 Austin, right? Where like, oh, we got a goal. Okay, hold on to it. And so I'm with you.
It was also more disciplined going the other direction, because you would see that, okay, we win the ball, we're going to break the other way, and it would be transitioning with two or three players.
Yeah.
Where the rest sat deeper, certain players didn't go past a certain point on the pitch. And this is, we're talking about the San Jose game a couple of weeks ago, where Josh Wolf says we don't want to get into a track meet, and as soon as anything goes wrong, we're in a track meet.
Yeah.
It's like, no, guys, this is what we said we didn't want to do. And the players were just like amped up and were just like, we're going to do it. We're going to go win this game. And
I get it. It's San Jose. They're like our most natural rival, I think, you know.
The San Jose Earthquakes are a kind of drug that makes you go crazy. But in this game, there were moments when, like, I think I was a little high on the San Jose drug. And there was like, okay, there's a moment to attack. Players are pushing forward. And then there would only be two guys trying to attack, and the rest of the players were like standing at midfield. And I was getting frustrated in the moment, like in the emotion of the moment, and then realizing like, oh, no, this is what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to stay right there so that when we lose the ball, Joseph Painsill doesn't run 60 yards and score 1v1 with Stuver. Yeah. And for the most part, they did that. They achieved this goal. And it was, I hope a good sign of them being a bit more disciplined in the moments when it needs that.
That said, I do think that there's a little bit of a point to the narrative online that possession for Austin doesn't always turn into winning numbers, right? In our three losses so far, we're averaging 57% of the ball. I know we've all heard it many times that Josh Wolf loves to say goals change games. And I think that's kind of indicative of that fact, right? When we look at, you know, the way we played against the Dynamo, who we knew weren't going to bury chances that they had, we had 33% possession against that team, playing away. That's like the lowest number I can ever remember Austin having. Even looking back on last year's terrible team, right? Our lowest possession match last year was still 38%. And so like to come out of there with a 1-0 win and then to have total 41% possession against the Galaxy on a 2-0 win at home, I can see where this narrative is coming from, right?
Yeah. We're going to get into this a little bit more with Paul Dolan in our Vancouver Whitecaps. I don't think we said that in the pregame, but we're going to have Paul Dolan from MLS Season Pass to preview the Vancouver Whitecaps game. And we talk about that with him. Like, what is this matchup going to look like possession-wise? Because Vancouver's a team who kind of gives the ball up at moments as well and just says, you have it, we're going to sit a little deeper and then try to break on you when you lose it. And so seeing how this matchup looks is going to be interesting.
Yeah, and then, you know, both of those mentalities that we've kind of leveraged lately and Vancouver tends to leverage also match up with the league-wide analysis, right? That in MLS, unlike every other major European league and some second-tier leagues, possession and points are not corollary. So in every other kind of big league around our quality or better, typically the team with the most possession also has the most points per game. In MLS, that is actually flipped in that teams with less possession tend to have a little bit higher points per game average. And so it's a very interesting kind of global soccer phenomenon that in MLS, possession doesn't always equal dominance.
Yeah. You'd have to think that like the huge home field advantage that teams have in MLS just because of the crazy travel and also the parity in MLS that you don't have Barcelona who's just going to like teams don't even try to press them.
Right.
They're just
exactly.
Gonna, like, we're going to sit in our box. You come meet us.
We're going to hope to God that you don't knock one in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not that. And so because of that, I think there are a lot more play styles that end up being viable options in MLS, even if roster construction limits that a little bit, right?
All right. The next thing I want to talk about was Diego Rubio. And I have this section in my notes titled Diego Rubio Dark Arts MVP.
Yeah, I'm glad you put this in this section of the show because I wanted to lead the show off talking about the Diego Rubio hat trick. And you made us put it lower, and I accept that.
What's a Diego Rubio hat trick, Mike?
Yeah, so for folks who maybe don't have a hockey history, right, there's such a thing as the Gordie Howe hat trick, which was a goal, an assist, and a fight. Because those were his hallmarks, right? He was a tough player who, like, supported his teammates and also could put one in the net. And there's a lot of that to Diego Rubio. I was shocked to find out that Diego Rubio hat trick wasn't already coined. But my pitch is this. A Diego Rubio hat trick is a goal. He gets a yellow card for doing something that's probably a red card. And then he draws a yellow card just by being aggravating.
Like forces someone else to get like
a yellow card. And in this game, he got the Diego Rubio hat trick within 10 minutes.
Oh, he didn't get a yellow though, did he?
No, but he definitely should have against Maya Yoshida pushing him down in the box.
Maybe a penalty too.
And so like... I am willing to accept for the Diego Rubio hat trick either a yellow that should have been a red or a regular foul that should have been a yellow card.
I kind of think it should be any getting a yellow or deserving a yellow and then forcing an opposing player to get a yellow.
Yeah.
I think that should count.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Let's go through some of his highlights of the game. So very early. There's a corner. This is right after our first goal. There's a corner, and all you see, like in the original broadcast, and I didn't catch this live in the stadium, but all you see in the broadcast is Caceres, their center back, shove Rubio, and he drops, and then just gets this look on his face, like, "How could you do this to me? I can't believe you would do this." And then they show a replay, and you see Diego Rubio just following Ricky Pooj around the box, putting his chest on him and like just talking mad, just chatting in his ear. And then Caceres comes up and pushes him and he drops and Caceres gets a yellow card for it.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
That was just the first one, just the first one.
And then before that, he's getting Ricky Pooj so upset and he pushes him around the field. Probably deserves a yellow then. But this one, like, that's not even the biggest deserved a yellow card moment.
Yeah, so the Yoshida and him go back and forth several times. Yoshida is like a big Japanese center back, like a tough dude. And they go up one time and trying to win, I think, a goal kick or something. And Yoshida kind of touches him on the back of the neck or the head. Rubio feels it. Not blaming him, not judging him. You feel contact like that, you drop. You're going to get the call every time. And Rubio knows this. He drops. Yoshida gets mad, but then like starts, like gives him applause. Like, okay, good. You earned that one. Good job. And then later on, Yoshida's playing a ball out of the back and Rubio leaves a little extra on one and knocks him down. And then later on, there's a corner. I think this is the point you were trying to get to, is the ref stops them twice, I think.
Yeah.
And like, this is usually Julio's job, right? Is the ref on a corner is going to come up and tell Julio at least twice during the game, like, hey, calm down or I'm going to give you a foul. This happens to Rubio. The ref backs up, starts play again, and immediately Yoshida is trying to like loop around and lose Rubio, and Rubio shoves him into the goal
with both arms, like both hands, full shove directly into the, like into the post. Absolutely should have been at least a yellow. If that ball is in play, it's guaranteed a penalty. Like,
I just love that Victor Rivas, the ref, is like a stern and like respected referee in MLS. And he says, Diego, you need to calm down. Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And then immediately yeets one of their biggest players into the net.
My favorite was Victor's reaction to this, too, was like, come on, Yoshida. Look how little Rubio is and look how big you are. He even does this like hand measurement thing to tell Yoshida why he shouldn't have gone down. Like, oh. We have not had a player like this since Felipe. I think
Diego's better than Felipe at it.
I was about to say, I don't think Felipe's as good as Diego is. I think we've got something really special here with Diego Rubio, and I am so glad he's on a 1-1 and not just a 1-year contract.
Yeah. And so later in the game, Rubio is receiving the ball like kind of in midfield. Fagundes, who comes on at halftime, comes in and fouls him really hard and takes the ball. And like, Fagundes was upset that the foul was called at all. But then also, again, on the replay, if you watch, Rubio feels the foul, goes down, and on the way down, grabs Fagundes's leg and like rolls over it. It's like, either as punishment or like saying, okay, if this foul doesn't get called, you're not getting that ball.
Yeah.
Maybe a little of both there.
And then Diego Fagundes is like kneeing at Rubio's back after the play, right? And
yeah.
Rubio's pushing on his legs. Like, it's just so playground.
And I think the best part of it all, and this is like one of the best moments, is like why it's so effective and why he's so good at it, is because I don't think Diego Rubio is ever actually mad.
No, I don't think so either. I think he's having a blast doing
it. Yeah. He's like playing the game. He's a great actor. And then you see in the speech after the game, he's just like the nicest man, like super thoughtful, very gentle speaker.
Yeah.
And like his English is fantastic and just like a great communicator. And then on the field, he's like this villain. And again, I don't think he's ever mad. I don't think his emotions ever get the best of him. I think he's playing a game 100% of the time and he's very good at it.
Yeah. I think it's both telling and incredible that his comment was, I've never played with a more honest group of guys. Meanwhile, he's playing this character the entire time he's on the field, right? Like he is 100% committed to the bit. And like afterward is like, man, I just really want to thank everyone in this locker room for being so honest and so committed and doing what we set out to with the plan from the coaching staff. Like, incredible. Josh Wolf in the post game talked about this and was like, yeah, Diego rides that red line like right up to it constantly and somehow never goes over. It's amazing. So like,
well, again, because he's never actually he never lets the emotions like boil over. He knows where he is and doesn't step over it. Where a lot of guys who play with that kind of energy, I think their emotions do get the best of them and do push them over that line sometimes. And you just don't really see that from him.
Yeah.
We mentioned Diego Fagundes. This is a point that I wanted to get into based on some conversations I saw online after this game. Diego Fagundes, of course, beloved by Austin FC fans, one of the highest performing players in Austin FC's short history, with mostly from that 2022 season when he was just lights out, really, really as good of a season as Driussi had. I don't think he would have had that kind of season without Fagundes there, and Fagundes would have gotten a lot more attention if Driussi had not been having such a killer season that year too. He gets, has a poor season. Roto comes in, trades him to LA Galaxy. Austin FC fans are heartbroken. I know what Diego's legacy is with Austin FC fans. What is Diego Fagundes's legacy in the Austin FC locker room?
Landon, what a spicy question. It's it's a Tuesday morning for the people listening to this. Are we sure that's a question? Like, so I worry that, like, you know, we aren't part of these conversations, right? We can only go by what we see. And what we saw on the field Saturday is that people weren't afraid to stick it to Diego on the field. And he wasn't afraid to stick it to our players on the field.
Yeah, you know, him and Gallagher got into it multiple times.
He came on the field and two hands shoved John Gallagher down to the ground, like almost immediately, letting him know, hey, I'm here to play. And John was glad to meet that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Johan Valencia subbed on, and like one of the very first things Johan did involved in play was a hard tackle on Diego in the middle of the field.
Yeah.
And so at the very least, we know that they are not going to be soft on him during, you know, the next match away in Carson.
Yeah. I mean, I think on the field, I don't think you should necessarily put a ton of stock into what happens on the field. These guys are competitors. These guys, like, during those 90 minutes, you're the enemy. And, like, even if they're best friends outside of the pitch. But what happens off the field, outside of the pitch? I know you sit over in that corner. Did you see any interesting interactions between Fagundes and players after the game?
After the game, I think the only player that I saw spend a whole lot of time with Diego was Danny. And that, like, on the rewatch was something else that I saw pretty apparently, right? They spent a lot of time showing that in the Apple TV broadcast as well. Other than that, you know, there was the general, like, quick hug, like, oh, good to see you. And then everybody kind of moving into their own spaces again. It didn't feel, for example, like when Sebastian Berhalter comes back with Vancouver and Danny and Owen, like, basically run over to give him hugs and, like, noogies and stuff after the game. You know what I mean? Like, they,
yeah,
it wasn't that kind of a bond.
You also talk about, like online presence, where whenever Diego Fagundes, like, he posted a farewell message at some point. And
yeah,
I saw people mention, like, pointing out, like, where are all the Austin FC players commenting on this thing? Because they do that, right? They'll comment on each other's social posts, and not that many of them did on this one.
Yeah, and so, I remember when Rodney left, even, you know, Rodney gave a farewell post, and a bunch of the players shared it out or commented on it, you know, oh, we'll miss you and things like that. And this was a guy that, you know, Austin FC fans, we couldn't wait for him to be out of contract. And the players clearly had a different relationship with Rodney in the locker room. A lot of posts about, you know, oh, we'll miss you, best of luck, da 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 da, things like that. Even Johan Romagna got, you know, love like that in his farewell post. And I didn't see much of that for Diego when he left last year.
Yeah, I think as like upset as most fans were by Fagundes being traded, I think a lot of fans assumed that every player was as upset as they were about Fagundes leaving. And Mike, we've talked enough about our youth to know, like, I'm going to assume this thing about you, and I think it's probably true. You can tell me if I'm wrong. But I'm going to guess that when you were younger, and probably even now, that you had friends that you liked spending time with, you enjoyed their company, but probably wouldn't want to work with them.
Certainly. And I have friends that, like, when they have needed a job, I have wished them luck, but have not recommended them to open positions where I work. You know what I mean?
Right. And vice versa. You have people that you work with and you love working with, but you're not going to hang out with on the weekends.
Right.
And so I think, again, speculating based on conversations from third hand sources or whatever, that I think it's probably likely that a fair amount of Austin FC players did not appreciate the professionalism or lack thereof that Diego Fagundes treated his job with, and that for that reason that they were not necessarily super upset to see him be traded. But I think it's like we view these guys as characters in a movie, and that everyone has to play their archetype or whatever. And that, like, they're people. They're normal people. Everything's gray. Nothing is black and white. Everything's complicated. These are normal humans like you and me, and life is hard.
Yeah, I think in general, there are players who love to be part of a community because they love to give back and do work in the community to make where they live a better place, right? And then I think there are some players who love to be part of a community because the community loves them. And I think, you know, as someone who has to work with one of those types, you would probably prefer the former to the latter.
Yeah. All right, anything else?
No, I don't think so. I think we could use an ad break.
Let's take a break. We'll be right back with more analysis of the 2-0 win over the Galaxy. When no one is around. Wintar Soccer is brought to you by our friends at FBF Law, the official injury lawyers of Austin FC.
FBF is a different kind of personal injury law firm dedicated to community, transparency, and client education. And they have their own podcast called Summary Judgment. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.
You can go to fef.law to find out what makes FEF a different kind of injury law firm and why understanding your legal options can dramatically change the outcome of a case. Once again, that's fef.law. Amplify Credit Union is a member-owned financial cooperative that served the needs of Central Texans for over 5 decades. As a credit union, Amplify has no shareholders or parent companies. That means more of your money stays in the community.
Amplify has been the home of fee-free banking since 2022. Their free checking accounts come with zero overdraft fees or minimum balance. That means Amplify's fee-free checking accounts help you get more mileage from your everyday spending.
Amplify membership is open to any Texas resident. Learn to trust your making in at Amplify Credit Union. To learn more and to register for free parking at the Amplify Esperanza branch on game day, go to www.goamplify.com/moontower-soccer.
Moontower Soccer is brought to you by Tony C's Pizza and Beer Garden, serving New York-style pizza and authentic Italian. Now open in Round Rock in front of Del Diamond and on Anderson Lane near Shoal Creek Boulevard.
The Anderson Lane Beer Garden is just 2 miles from Q2 Stadium. Stop by for a pizza and a pint before all of this year's home games. And with TVs on every wall, it's the perfect spot to watch all away games. And as we pointed out every week, that they play all the Austin FC games with sound on, which is crucial.
Also, it smells exactly like a New England pizza place, and I love that so much. My fellow Massachusetts transplants, next time that you're missing like Papagino's, this is your spot. Trust me. As always, there are two for Tuesdays coming up. Two pizzas for the price of one every Tuesday. And then Pitcher Perfect Thursdays as well, which is half price pitchers of beer every Thursday.
Dine in or pick up for lunch or dinner at Tony C's Pizza and Beer Garden. Check them out online at tonycsbeergarden.com. All right, we are back. Mike, let's jump into the rest of the details of the LA Galaxy match. Before we get into the match events, let's talk about some of the pre-game storylines. The first one I start off with is Real Madrid president Florentino Perez was there hanging out with one of the owners, Eddie Margain. Why?
Do you want the real answer or the fake answer?
Both.
I don't know the real answer, but I do know that the fake answer is that he's buying Josh and Owen Wolf for $20 million this summer.
We took my parents and my brother to this game, and they announced Real Madrid president Florentino Perez. I was like, why is he here? And my brother said, maybe he was going to buy one of the Austin players. And I just turned and said, he doesn't want our players.
That's not true. I have it on good authority that all of our players would make the Galacticos better.
So there has been a recent announcement.
After they dominated the Galaxy, maybe I'm right. Moderately dominated the Galaxy.
Maybe you're right, Mike. Maybe you're right. There was an announcement recently that La Liga teams will be playing games in the United States, but surely they wouldn't, like, surely Q2 is not a real candidate for that, right?
No, I would assume it's too small. Yeah, it would have to be at like DKR at the very least in Austin, right? Or MetLife or whatever it's called in Arlington, like the,
I don't know what it's called.
Jerry
the
World?
The range. Oh, yeah, that one. Jerry World. That's what it's called. You could also, it's like he was at the Mavs game the night before. Luka Doncic played for Real Madrid. And so there's a connection there. And maybe he was in Dallas and they were like, I want to go see a soccer game. And then they showed them, you could go to FC Dallas.
Right.
Like, is there a different one? It's like, oh yeah, Austin's just a few hours down the road. And they showed him pictures of that. It's like, oh, I'm going to do that instead.
Yeah. If you have the choice of a Texas Derby, populated by pickup trucks or Austin FC playing Ricky Pooj, you might choose the latter over the former.
All right, let's get into the Austin FC pregame storyline. So Julio Cascante was out with suspension the week before against Houston. We talked on last week's show about like what's the right call in this game. Do you go with the arguably better defensive pairing in Hedges and Hynes-Eich, or do you slot Cascante back in the starting lineup? What we ended up getting was Cascante and Hynes-Eich. And again, talking about the game plan, we did keep the ball more up until we got those two goals, and like Julio's good at that. And I don't know that he was like necessarily super involved in directly in any of the goals, but we know that a lot of the value he adds is like on those margins, right? So who's to say that he didn't still add value there? But then once we did shift to the more defensive mindset or the more conservative mindset, he was still not a liability there. He still did well. And I think just like not putting him in the position to be in that track meet, like he does fine. He does a decent job then.
Yeah. I had said before the match that this might have been my hottest take of 2024. But if Julio wasn't in the starting lineup, I didn't think we were going for a win against LA Galaxy, because LA is so susceptible on corners and set pieces and in the air. It felt like leaving Julio on the bench would have been a real keeping one of our best weapons in the offensive phase of the game against this team. Like, how can you not play him if you want to win?
And not just on set pieces, but in the buildup, in distribution, like he is an asset in those moments. And if you think you can go toe-to-toe with the Galaxy, or if you think your best chance is to use the ball and score some goals, he's a plus in that category. I think one of the other questions was who's going to play on the wing? With Owen Wolf was still listed as questionable. Ragone scored a goal. I don't know that, like, we're necessarily like Ragone has to start in this one, but we've talked about how he's a confidence player. And so I don't mind this call. If you say, okay, he's a confidence player. He got a little bit of that confidence last week. Try to keep it rolling, put him out there, see what he can do. You can always pull him at halftime if he sucks again, but which is probably not great for his confidence. But as like, did you have a problem with him starting?
I wouldn't say I had a problem because I didn't feel like we had a real choice outside of him, because this team is just too fast to make Ethan try and keep up for 90 minutes or even 70 minutes. You know, I thought depending on what training looked like, there was like maybe the world's smallest outside shot of a CJ start with a with a Ragone. No, like
that's never happening.
No, of course not. But like CJ also had a really good game against Houston when he came on with his limited minutes, and so
equally as good as Ragone, you could argue.
yeah. And so in my head, I'm like, well, you know, if there's a chance that Ragone gets a start, maybe there's a chance that CJ gets some minutes here. But
yeah, my take is that it's all shades of gray, right? Yes. Like, I don't think one of the other options is so much better that it's an obvious choice. So yeah, I was fine with it just on the confidence angle alone. This was a thing that I noticed last week as we were like coming up to this game, is like, this is the first time we had a full bench of first team players this year.
20 players all on the first team. We did it.
and not injured.
Like, and we didn't even have to name three goalkeepers to the 20.
That's right.
So that's pretty good.
Again, this is progress. This is what progress looks like. All right, getting into lineup, it was Brad Stuver in goal. Then we got Gallagher at right back. Hedges and Heinzeich in the middle, Beer at left back, then Danny Pereira, Alex Ring, and Driussi in the midfield, and then O'Brien, Rubio, and Ragone up top. So getting into some of the events, we already talked about some of the Diego Rubio's off-ball highlights a little earlier on. I think getting into the rest of the match events, there was a penalty shout like in the fifth minute or so where O'Brien is making a run in the box. And I mean, in person and on the replay, you see him run into a group of people and then drop. And it was like, surely that's a penalty, right? Like he goes down upon replay. I'm pretty sure he tripped over Diego Rubio's leg.
So I couldn't tell whose leg he tripped over. Steph was like, the only reason I can see why they might not have given it is because there's a question about Diego Rubio being involved.
I'm pretty sure most of the contact was with Rubio's leg in that moment. So I think this is fair. Not long after that, the first goal comes, though. This is like 2 minutes after that penalty shout. It starts with a forced turnover in the press. So Ragone and Danny Pereira are pressuring a Galaxy player out towards the sideline. They cough up the ball. It falls to Driussi. He plays it centrally to Ring, who plays a ball upfield to Rubio's feet, one-touch layoff to O'Brien, and then he starts a run behind Caceres, who stepped up to Mark Rubio, or sorry, stepped up to Mark O'Brien. O'Brien slips it behind Caceres as Rubio's running into that space that Caceres left behind him and is able to turn, first touch, finish, and just a really beautiful combination of passes there to lead to that goal. But it all starts with that press in over on the sideline with Ragone and Danny Pereira putting pressure on those players wide. And once they get the ball, being able to play quickly, get the ball moving, get into a dangerous space. And then the chemistry of those guys playing off of each other and finding that space to finish it off.
Yeah. And I mean, these are runs that like we don't see all of 2023, right? A fast winger coming down to relieve some pressure from our midfield. And then like a striker with pace, making a striker's run into a space where a striker should be to receive the ball and score. These two dudes, Rubio and Obreon, make this attack so much different than we've seen in years past.
Yeah, so not long after that, Joseph Paintsil gets his first chance. He gets the ball in space wide left and is driving. I think it's Ring and someone else, but he gets into the box, unleashes a shot. Luckily, there's enough traffic that wherever he puts it, it's probably going off somebody. And so where he puts it on goal is right at Brad Stuver, and Stuver is Stuver and does a good job and blocks it out of danger. Paintsil really only gets one or two other chances this whole match, which is part of why Austin FC was able to pull this one out. But I think the Galaxy had a little bit of an off day, but also Austin FC players deserve credit for the work that they put in. We'll get into some of those individual performances later on.
Yeah. I think there's one other really good chance from Paintsil that I can remember in the game, a little bit after, our second goal. But other
is it
than
the,
that,
the one off of the quick restart?
Yes.
Yeah. So Austin FC fouls someone and is complaining about the foul being called. And while they're complaining to Victor Rivas, nobody's standing over the ball. They restart it quickly. Paintsil gets played into the box 1v1 with Stuver. It's from a off to the right, so the angle is not the easiest, but it's still a super dangerous moment. And Stuver does really well to get a hand on it.
Yeah.
To push that one out. But to have that be his like guy who's considered one of the best players, like top two or three players in the league at the moment, to limit him to really only two big chances, and one of them being kind of a fluke thing where it's less of him being
play.
Right. It's like not because he beat anybody, it's because they weren't focused and weren't paying attention to the restart.
But
second goal comes not long after that in the 19th minute. This is Hutter Obreon gets the goal this time. So I think Ring has the ball in midfield and gets dispossessed. The ball ends up with Miguel Berry, their striker, in kind of the half space on their attacking half. Ring chases him down, slides in from behind to tackle him, comes up with the ball at his feet, immediately turns, looks upfield, plays a through ball in behind to Obreon, who's already running vertically. And Obreon is able to take it wide right of the goal. As the keeper comes off, he just hammers it across the face of goal and thumps it in across, like thumps the far post and pings it in. I think this is, I'm hoping this is a sign of these attacking players building chemistry together.
Yeah.
That these guys that Obreon, Driussi, Rubio and Ring, like those are some of these, like Driussi and Ring were already like going back to that 2022 season, key parts of our attack. You bring in these two new guys who we think could be good in the right setup, in the right circumstances. And I'm hoping this is us finally seeing these guys starting to learn each other's tendencies, gelling together a little bit better. And you see that with these like one touch layoffs. So in that first goal, when Ring plays the ball into Rubio's feet, he one touch lays it off to Obreon and then makes that run, and Obreon immediately plays him in behind. That's a thing. That's a chemistry thing. Like it's a soccer IQ thing, but you also start to learn tendencies. You learn what guys like to do. And those little one touch layoffs, we saw a lot of that during the game where they would play a ball vertically to Rubio to play out of pressure, and he would lay it off first touch to someone else, and they'd switch play from there. And then Driussi did the same thing where play it to Driussi out of pressure. He'd one touch lay it off to Ring, who would switch it out of play or carry it out of the danger area there. And this is not a pattern that we've seen a lot of from Austin FC. And we saw it several times in this game.
Yeah, the other thing that we're seeing is that happening across the field, right? There are a number of times where Brendan Hines-Ike receives a pass in the middle of the field because he's, you know, carrying the ball forward. And he's doing these same gentle layoffs to players around him because he knows someone's coming through the middle to, like, help him out and let him drop back a little bit back into that, like, more secure defensive position. Yeah, I think... Whatever's in the water, keep that pH balance where it's at because this chemistry is good, baby.
And then again on Obreon's goal, the when Ring wins that tackle, great tackle.
Oh my gosh!
To begin with,
it's like then NYCFC Ring, like vintage classic Alex Ring, big destroying tackle, keeps the ball with him. Like, oh
yeah, in most of Austin FC's history, we've not had players who like to stretch the field and run in behind. And so I think a player like Ring, he's intelligent enough and like his vision is good enough that he'll see that run. And so I think once we brought in guys like Obreon and then this year trying to play a bit more vertically, the guys who have been here don't know what to do with it. And it's not instinctive for them to look for it. And the fact that Alex Ring, one of these like legacy Austin players, his first instinct was to look up and launch a ball vertically, and Obreon's already running on. That is also that chemistry I'm talking about where, like, these guys are learning how to play with each other, and I'm hoping that can continue and build more on that and just learn to make each other better by learning each other's tendencies and playing into those.
And I think we're seeing the benefit of, like, Alex working on that as well, right? Because he was trying some of these passes at the beginning of the season and his body just wasn't letting those passes work. He wasn't strong enough or he wasn't fit enough or whatever. And in this match, it looks like his condition is back to where it needs to be able to hit those passes. And I don't know if that's a like, I'm familiar with this movement in this passing range now, or if that's just a, like, we are at the point in training where now I know what I need to be doing to make myself able to do those things.
I mean, and the answer is probably a little of all of those things, right? Like, soccer is a complicated sport. after this point, 2-0 up, Austin kind of goes into game management mode. We talked about how they started playing a bit more disciplined, not throwing as many numbers forward, counterattacking with just a couple of players, and it works. I mean, the Galaxy get, I think, two other decent chances in that half. One of them is that painful moment off of the restart that Stuver saves. The other is Ricky Pooj super late in the half.
Hits
a beautiful shot. It's going upper 90 from about 25 yards out, and Stuver gets a hand on it and pushes it over. Like, really good save, but excellent strike from Pooj there. But really, for the next 25 minutes, those are the only two dangerous moments that the Galaxy get. Halftime comes, Galaxy makes two subs. They bring on Jalen Neal, who's a young, super promising center back that has been injured for a lot of the season. They pull off Caceres, who's already been very worked up by Diego Rubio and is on a yellow card. So they pull him off, put on Neal. They also pull off the striker, Miguel Berry, for Fagundes. They move Joseph Paintsil centrally to play striker. Fagundes goes to the left wing. I mean, Fagundes, I think he had a decent game. I don't think he was bad, but they kept him fairly quiet. Just not necessarily him, but just the attack in general. Austin's defense was able to keep the whole attack pretty quiet.
Yeah, there were three shots in the box at all in the second half from LA. The rest of their second half shots, all 10 of them, come from outside the box there. So, or I guess the last seven of those shots come from outside the box.
Yeah. One thing, 10 shots in the second half. And like I don't know that there's one of them that you could call particularly dangerous really in the whole second half.
No, I felt worried because I couldn't believe I wasn't more stressed. You know what I mean?
We've been conditioned as Austin FC fans to think like this is all going to fall apart at any minute now. But from what was happening on the field, if you take away like our learned fear in these moments, there was nothing happening on the field for us to think like we're in danger now. Like we're going to give up this 2-0 lead. Like if you're a neutral is watching this game, it's like, no, Austin's going to win. There's no way they're going to lose this game.
The only thing I will say about this second half Galaxy structure that like I think is underappreciated is how good Paintsil was as the nine. He really pulled apart Austin center backs. Julio especially bit on a lot of like ball movement where Paintsil would come into the box and then carry out and like drag Julio with him.
Yeah, and then Fagundes would loop back in
right, and
occupy that central space. And yeah, Julio would go out and just kind of contain. And then to the rest of the players' credit, like they did a good job of filling in those gaps. And as he played it back in, did a good job of keeping it pretty limited.
Yeah. Peck was a lot more involved in the second half. And I think a lot of that is because Paintsil was pulling apart his side of the defense a lot more. But even still, not super threatening, which I can't believe I'm saying that.
Yeah. First, Austin's first sub comes at the 58th minute. And it's Jader Obreon comes off. I was a little surprised to see his number called in that moment. Were you surprised then?
I was surprised, but only because he had just made a pretty hardcore run. I assume that on the sideline, like they knew what they were looking for in that run and he just wasn't quite able to give it. And they were like, okay, cool. We've seen this. We've seen this with hot air before, right? Usually by the 65th, certainly by the 70th, the man is like cooked. You simply can't run that fast for that long and not get tired in MLS, right?
Yeah, I think the legs are definitely part of it, but also keep in mind, he's on a yellow. He got a yellow card in like the 20th minute or something like that. And so that factors into it. If you look at game state, Jader Obreon, I would say, is probably, of our winger group, probably the worst defender of them as far as just like defensive mentality and positioning and things like that. I'd say he's probably the worst one. They bring on Owen, which for game state, I think this is exactly when you bring on Owen Wolf, right? Like, he's one of the best athletes on the team. Often Wolf was kind of tracking back and even following wingers of the overlapping fullback into like all the way up to that front line and playing as part of like a back five at times. But Owen puts in a really good shift defensively and then has some really good like possession combinations up top to kind of keep the ball and kill the game off a little with possession and get Austin in some of those dangerous moments you mentioned. Like Austin did get some good chances later on and Owen was involved in a couple of them.
Yeah.
And so I was in the moment, like immediately like a little bit surprised to see Obreon come off, but in hindsight with the context and the yellow and the legs, like I think this was the right move. And like Owen had a good game for what he was sent in to ask to do. I think he executed perfectly.
Yeah, I thought this was one of Owen's more solid substitution like appearances. You know, I think sometimes he can like be a little bit slow to get involved in the game, but it didn't feel like that at all. And in fact, I thought watching the game that like I was taken aback by how physically developed Owen is now as a player against other grown men in MLS. He doesn't look 18 out there. You know, he doesn't look young. He looks like he's physically holding his own now in a way that we haven't necessarily seen with our eyes so much as the way that he plays, right? Because he's never been afraid to get stuck in. But now the way that he does it is a lot less spicy challenges and a lot more body position and just like standing dudes up. And so I thought it was a really, really good shift from Owen Wolf. His FOP mob scores don't quite tell the whole story with him today.
I mean, but it's like, this was Owen Wolf put in like a workmanlike shift.
Yes.
And in a different game, I don't know, like this is kind of the horses for courses approach that I hope Josh Wolf takes. Like, I saw some people upset that CJ Faudrey didn't get put in when they pulled Obreon. This is not the game for CJ Faudrey. If we're losing 2-0, let's put on CJ instead of Owen. But if we're winning 2-0, Owen's the right choice there.
Well, and it's important to call out too that, like, originally the plan for the next set of subs was going to be CJ. And because CJ ran over from the subs bench to put on his jersey.
Oh, interesting.
He had taken off his warm-up top and was getting ready to put his jersey on. And they ended up going with the Jossi sub after that instead.
Huh.
Because they saw Rubio was this close to that yellow card after the Diego Fagundes foul. And so they made the call then to switch the sub plan and go with Jossi instead of CJ to get a little bit of height to kind of lock that down a little bit. Because they're complementary and opposite players, right?
Yeah.
They can each do part of one thing that the other can do and then have, you know, a little bit of the other stuff to go along with that.
Yeah, so Austin FC sees it out. Again, not really many dangerous chances for the rest of the game. As I said earlier, they finish the weekend in seventh place. This means Austin FC is a great team and we're never going to win. And we're never going to lose again, right? Is that what it means?
That's exactly what it means. And certainly not coming up against the number two team in the West next week.
Yeah. I like, we are, as fans, mercurial. And whenever we lost before, everything was the worst. And now we won this one and everyone's feeling great. I think, as with most things in life, the real answer is somewhere in the middle.
Like, of course.
We're going to have bad games again this year. We're going to have good games again this year. I think what we can hold on to and be happy about is that this kind of performance is possible with this group of players. That every once in a while it's going to come out and we can do that. And that gives me hope that we can stay in that playoff hunt until maybe we can get a couple of reinforcements in the summer, which is what we've all said would be like our ceiling for this year, right? Is stay in the race, get some help in the summer, finish off the season strong. And it looks like after this game, that's what I'm taking from, is that is possible. That is possible this year.
Yeah. I think, you know, the pace that we're on right now, especially Driussi coming back, that pace is incredible. Overall on the season, about 1.5 points per game, not bad. Certainly not compared to the rest of the West, right? Like, that's basically where, I mean, obviously, it's going to be middle of the table. And if we can hold on to lower end of the playoff spaces until those summer reinforcements come, there's a chance, you know, we could make a little bit of noise. And especially if the ownership group decides to spend around that.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break. We're going to come back. We have quite a bit of news to go over. We're going to talk about John Coleman's contract extension, a transfer rumor, and then Danny Pereira's, I guess, changes in legal status and his status for the Vancouver game. And then also the report from ESPN that Austin will host the 2025 MLS All-Star Game. Hang tight. We'll be right back.
Our premier sponsor is McGuire Woods Consulting, helping clients in the public affairs space, from lobbying at the local, statewide, and federal levels to digital and communications campaigns across the country.
McGuire Woods Consulting has offices in 10 MLS cities, but only advertises on this podcast because it's the home of the two-time reigning Copa Teos champions, which is the most important trophy in professional sports. Contact our friends at McGuire Woods Consulting at mwcllc.com for more information.
Moon Tower Soccer is brought to you by Sage Wilson Realty. The team is made up of Austin experts who are client-focused and have over 30 years of combined real estate experience. Our friends at Sage Wilson Realty are giving away two tickets to an upcoming match. Fill out the form in the show notes for your chance to win.
If you or someone you know or need a Sage real estate advice in Austin, talk to our friends at Sage Wilson Realty. Be sure to check them out online at sagewilson.com. All right, we are back. We're going to jump into what was a decent amount of Austin FC news as we started the day and kind of doubled in size as the day went on. A quick little hit is Nico Arisizabal, who is the U17 goalkeeper for the Austin FC Academy, was called up to the Puerto Rican U16 national team. He was the goalkeeper for the U15 group that won Generation Adidas Cup, and then as a 15-year-old is currently starting for the U17 team. And so, yeah, really promising guy. Hopefully that will lead to more international experience for him. Let's get into first team news here. So Jean Kolmanic gets a contract extension. I don't have this pulled up. Do you have the details of that extension?
It is a 1-1. It is a one-year extension with a one-year option, and it takes effect after this season.
So he's going to remain a U22 player for all of this year, and then will become a senior player after that. And that is that is, we know that because of reporting from Phil West. Mm-hmm. And so I saw a lot of people saying, like, okay, Kolmanic was injured, comes back. He's not starting this year. It looks like Biru's our number one for the foreseeable future. Why is Kolmanic getting an extension, and why is it happening now?
Yeah, those are all the notes that you have on this is two bullet points. One says why, and one says, and why now? and I think they're both fair questions. You know, I think a lot of us were expecting Jean Kolmanic's contract to end in December and to get one of those thanks for growing the legend kind of posts from him.
Yeah, I think as far as like the why now part, the longer you let negotiations go, the more leverage a player and his agent have, and the more likely you are to overpay to keep them or to lose them on a free and they just walk away.
Because in Europe you're allowed to start negotiating with players 6 months before their contract ends, and so if he were to go to a European team, they could make that deal in June. And then we wouldn't be able to get anything for that. And so if we want to be able to potentially recoup a transfer fee for Jean Kolmanic, he needs to be under contract past December.
Exactly. Yeah. So to answer why now, if you're looking to keep him, the sooner the better. Like that's when you're going to get have the best negotiation stance is earlier. So I think that's why now. As for why, I think this is maybe the more interesting part for a guy who our hopes aren't as high for him as they once were. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
But I think what this means is that Rodolfo Borrell and company think that Jean Kolmanic has value. That value is either on the pitch or in the transfer market. I don't know. Maybe it's both. But they believe that. I think that is the part that is up for debate. Like, does he have value? I don't know. Like, can he become a bit more multidimensional as a player? Can he stay healthy? Like, these are things we don't know as far as on the field. But as far as in the transfer market, he's still a pretty young guy, played at a decent level and in his country as a young player. And he's not that expensive. So there will be teams who will be interested in Jean Kolmanic, either in MLS or abroad. There will be. And if he's making $1 million, yeah, no, they're not. But he's cheap and he's young. There's going to be a market for him. And so either if you think you can play him or trade him or sell him, any of these things, yeah, re-sign him. Don't let him walk away for free, because the player we just described has value in some form or another. And so I'm curious to see what that plan actually is and what that value they actually see is, and if that value actually exists. But this is a sign to me that Borrell believes that value exists somewhere.
And at this point, honestly, if Burrell believes it, it's good enough for me. I know we talked off air before the show about like his resume right now, and good Lord, I'm just so happy he's here.
It's still small sample size, but from the players he's added to the squad, he hasn't missed yet. And right. So I'm not willing to go all in and say Rodolfo Burrell's a genius. He's going to save this club because we haven't seen enough yet. But
he's king of Boston FC. I've crowned him. Just you know that Biggie picture with the like crooked crown.
Yeah,
do that with Rodolfo Burrell's face. Oh my God!
Somebody yeah. Photoshopped that for us. I am encouraged though. From what we've seen so far, I am encouraged. More transfer rumors. I guess we can call this a report. This is coming from. I don't know. It's hard to say. These are like Hungarian outlets that are reporting this. So I don't know what these outlets are. I don't know what their track record is. But reports saying that Austin FC are interested in signing Henry Wingo, who is Seattle Sounders Academy product and currently playing for Ferencvaros, who is the like Hungarian giant. They're like the biggest team in Hungary at the moment. So for the Seattle Sounders, this is my memory of Henry Wingo is that he mostly played like as a wide midfielder, sometimes as a fullback. And so I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like we're bringing in another fullback when we're already linked with the fullback this summer. We just signed one of the guys we thought might not be around. What does this mean? Looking a little bit further into it, he's been playing mostly as a center back for Ferencvaros. And so
backline
kind of like,
FC.
That's right. I think like we're talking about like the possession disparity in Europe. Ferencvaros is one of those giants that like they keep the ball. I watch some clips, like they have the ball and they keep the ball. And so he's a bit more in like kind of that new role of guys who are probably traditionally fullbacks that we're going to play as a center back because you're good enough at defending, but you can play with the ball. And that's kind of what little I watched. I'll dive, if this becomes more of a real thing, I'll dive in and do a proper scouting report on this guy. But from what I saw, that was my take on it. So whether he's a center back or a fullback or whatever it is, that's kind of that Kyle Walker role where it's like 10 years ago, you're a fullback, but in the modern game for this style of play, you're a center back now. Looking at like, I made a tweet that maybe made some folks a little bit unhappy after this report came out, but bringing in Mikkel Dessler this summer, Guilherme Biru looks like he's going to be a starter. Like if he can keep his trajectory up, he's going to be a really good MLS player. Just re-signed John Kolmanich. We've got John Gallagher sitting here. Where does he fit in to this puzzle at this point? If this is what our backline landscape looks like. And if we're looking at guys like Burrell has said, everyone's for sale, like come get them. Everyone's for sale. If we're looking at like assets now, I think before we talked about like Nick Lima being the most tradable asset, and not because he's bad, not because we don't like him, because he's the most valuable asset that someone's willing to pay for. As we bring in these other pieces, especially if Wingo brings in too, I think John Gallagher becomes that piece, like the most valuable piece that we can trade and upgrade or make a sideways move on for free or cheaper. John Gallagher is that guy. So I'm not saying I want it to happen, but I would not be shocked if John Gallagher gets traded this summer.
Landon, you had so many chances to walk this back and instead you're going to double down on it.
I'm going to double down on it. I think seeing that Wingo could like, if Burrell's idea going forward is to move to like more of a back three with more ball playing center backs and play with wing backs, maybe Gallagher is safe in that thing. He's still probably not a starter. If Biru continues to improve and Dessler comes in, Gallagher's sitting on the bench. And so, like, even then, and then if, let's say Wingo plans to play wide, that's depth there. Like, where's the plan here? And so I think there's a little bit of writing on the wall that could be in the works. But then also just looking at trade value, Gallagher is in his late 20s. He's like 27, 28, something like that. He's got guaranteed contract through 26 with an option year, I believe. So a few more years on the contract, and he's on a club-friendly deal. He's not expensive for how proven of a player he is. You could get a good amount of allocation money for this guy. Like, there's value there. Like, you could turn that money, and especially Wingo's on a free, Dessler's going to be on a free. So if you can upgrade the position while cashing in on assets you already have, like, that's good business, and I can't be mad if that's what they end up doing. And yeah, don't be surprised.
I gotta ask though, Landon, what about how not deep we are at the wing position? Because I've seen talk of this, that like, if we bring in all these fullbacks, John Gallagher becomes wing depth. Does he slot in above an Ethan Finley maybe on the wing?
This was the response I got from several people when I brought up the idea about trading Gallagher. I don't think John Gallagher is an upgrade on the wing for us right now.
Certainly not on our starting lineup. But what about in the depth chart? Do you really think he's below Ethan at this point in Ethan's career?
I honestly think I would play Finley over Gallagher on the wing right now. I was critical of Gallagher's wing play when he was still a wing. I think he's at his best attacking when he's got some momentum behind him, and he can, like, on that overlap when he's got some speed going up. When he receives the ball with his feet, like to his feet with his heels on the chalk line, he's not very good in that moment, which, to be fair, none of our wingers are. But like, that doesn't mean we should just, like, I don't think except, him being
being
the same as our current wingers a reason to do it the same way. Like, if we can change it and upgrade it, that's what good MLS teams do.
Sorry, Galley Gals. I tried.
I love John Gallagher. I love his attitude. I love his work rate. I love watching him play. But if Burrell's going to be like a cutthroat businessman and really like be aggressive in turning over this roster and making it better, that is the next piece that I think he could move.
I tried to get him to walk it back. I tried.
All right, let's get into the Danny Pereira news. So this is reporting mostly coming from Alex Sanabria, I believe.
Also Danny Pereira's Instagram.
Right, he posted a photo of himself in Venezuela.
But and tagged
Alex has been following like the Danny's like visa status and yes, all of that quite closely. And so Danny Pereira posts a photo of himself in Venezuela. And so Alex's reporting is saying he believes Danny's there to get his Venezuelan passport renewed, which with his current legal status had not been really a feasible option for a long time. With his visa status and everything moving forward, this feels like a step for him to start playing more with the Venezuelan national team, to have a bit more freedom of movement between countries, whether to play for Venezuela, to play in Canada with Austin FC, or to move to another country to play professionally. What it means currently for Austin FC is that it seems unlikely for him to be back to play in this Vancouver match.
I am not thrilled about that. But I am thrilled that Danny is getting the paperwork taken care of, because I know, like, from personal experience how stressful it is when your visa runs out and you are in a country where you need that stuff taken care of so that you can stay and work there. So, I'm super glad that this will be off his back. And he'll be able to move forward with the Venezuelan national team. But man, are we going to miss him in Vancouver if what Paul Dolan's kind of perception of Vancouver turns out to be true.
Yeah. It has to be Valencia slotting in for him, right? Like, there's not.
Yeah. What else would we do?
You could see Alex Ring play the six and put, I guess, Owen Wolf in Ring slot, like in Ring's position. I just think Alex Ring has proved so invaluable to the attack that I think moving him deeper hurts the offense too much. And so
do we,
if we're going to play a more pragmatic game, play Valencia at the six, have Ring and Driussi, because Driussi's been dropping in the buildup and being a bit more connected in the buildup, have that kind of supplement what we're lacking in having Danny back there. It's not going to be the same, but hopefully it's enough. But I just don't see another way that they could go.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I just am very worried about those. Like, we have no way to get out of any sort of press problems that we ran into earlier in the season.
Yeah, it seems like Vancouver doesn't do a full-on press anyway, so hopefully it's not a problem, but it still could be. I don't know. The news that came out, like, after I got off work today, so a few hours before we started recording, is ESPN is reporting that Austin FC is going to be the host of the 2025 MLS All-Star Game. That's about as much detail as we got. I'd say I'm excited about this. I'm not super surprised about this. The last several years, they've tended to give it to newer teams or teams who have recently built new stadiums, trying to highlight these stadiums, show them off a little bit. And Austin is one of the new ones that hadn't gotten it yet. And so I figured it was going to happen sometime in the next 2 or 3 years, but wasn't quite sure when. Excited to see that it is next year, 2025.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I can't wait to see the gigantic skee ball machine in the middle of the field. I will be cheering so hard for the skills and drills. I love that stuff. It's so cheesy. It's so fun.
I've always wanted to go to MLS All-Star because it is like a several day event. And I don't know, like, all the MLS media goes there. The Cooligans go, like, yeah. It just seems like a fun time just to, like, go and, like, be a part of the festivities. But I couldn't justify taking 3 days off of work to go to the MLS All-Star game in DC or whatever. The fact that it's going to be here, like, I'll be able to take part in a lot of it. I'm really excited. I think it's gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm super stoked. I really hope 2025 is the year that we go back to East versus West.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible.
We'll have 15 teams in each league. Like, we can build out.
And enough stars in the league.
Right.
It would be a good, like, it would be a draw, right? To see, like, the best players from every team put out on the field. Like, I think that's fun now. It wasn't maybe the biggest draw 10 or 15 years ago, but I think it is now.
Yeah, I think we're ready. Don't be a coward, MLS. Do it.
All right, let's take a quick break. We're going to come back with Paul Dolan. Paul is a former MLS and international player, has been doing broadcasting for quite a while now, was the Vancouver Whitecaps on their calls for several years before the Apple deal comes in, and has been calling a lot of their games this year. So super knowledgeable about this team, and we're excited to do the preview with him. Hang tight. All right, we are thrilled to be joined by Paul Dolan. Paul is a former Vancouver Whitecaps player and a former Canadian national team player, currently working for Apple TV on MLS Season Pass. Paul, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Happy to do it anytime. Enjoyed it last year and looking forward to this year as well.
All right, well, normally we start off telling our guests that we don't expect them to be an expert on every team because you guys are calling a lot of different games, but just so happens this week you are an expert on the Vancouver Whitecaps, so we're going to grill you a little harder than we normally do.
Grill away, that's fine. I've seen all of their games this year. I've tried to keep up with every other team as well. You know, that's what we're asked to do, which I completely understand, and try to be neutral as well. And I will be on the weekend, but I'm doing my best to keep up with everything Austin-wise as well.
All right, well, let's look at, I guess it's still early enough in the season, we could probably keep doing this, but 2023 results, they finished sixth in the West, lost in the playoffs to LAFC. They lost a few players, some probably bigger names than were Impact. Is Gressel the biggest difference from last year to this year? And he wasn't even there all year last year, right?
He was their best player through the first half of the year. So when he left and was traded first to Columbus, of course, he's moved on to Inter-Miami now. It was a bit of a shock to the system. But Vanni Sarratini will tell you this more than any other coach in the league, that the team is the leader and that every player is replaceable, although he does have a teacher's pet, and we can touch on him later. I'll tease that one. But Julian Gressel was fantastic. He played kind of as a more wingback throughout most of his career, but for Vancouver was very central and created a lot of chances. But when he left, the Whitecaps were able to pick up the pieces because they are very team-oriented first, and they have pieces that can come in. And Ryan Raposo has done a decent job in that area. Ali Ahmed, who is a young player who came in this year and has really started to blossom, has also picked up the pieces. And then Fafa Pico this year, who they signed as a free agent, and Demir Krylak, two veterans that you didn't really think would have a huge starting impact. Well, Fafa Pico, in three consecutive games, scored a goal, assisted in two of the games as well, and then was injured, so hasn't really featured much since then. But those are the big additions this year. And if you mentioned the one, key loss last year, it would have been Gressel for sure.
And then at the guys coming in, you mentioned Pico already. Demir Krylak is a guy, he's getting a little older, but an excellent player. How has he factored into this team so far this year?
You know, I think he has as much to do with the team's spirit and chemistry off the field as a leader. That's not what he wanted to come in for. He didn't sign with Real Salt Lake because they had plans for him to be more of an impact player off the bench. And he felt he still had starting legs and starting minutes. And Vanni Sarratini felt the same way. And he started Demir Krylak in the first few games. He actually scored against Salt Lake. He scored in the Champions Cup as well, CONCACAF Champions Cup. And he's a threat to score, but I don't feel that he's the perfect fit for the Whitecaps in terms of what they want to do this year, more than even last year, which is they tend to allow the opposition to have the ball. Their defensive line is among the lowest in the league this year and not incredibly high offensive or defensive pressure from the offensive front three, although they do swarm on occasion. But Demir Krylak doesn't have that speed necessarily to get in behind when the Whitecaps do win the ball back and kill you in the transition. So I think for the most part, he'll be more prominent as a player that comes on later in games who knows how to score. And he's obviously got that pedigree, shows up in the right spot, is a big target in the air as well. And I think he can be still a key contributor on the field as well as off.
Yeah. Somebody we haven't mentioned yet that I think is like really key to Vancouver's strength is Andres Kubas. I know, like, as a DP, right? A lot of fans in the league would think of, oh, you give DP contracts to guys who are going to get on the score sheet. But that's not necessarily always Andres's game, right?
No. He is the preeminent, and again, I'll use Vanni Sartini's quotes because he is the quote master in this league, isn't he? But he thinks he's the best defensive midfielder in the league. He did throw some flowers to Jose Martinez in Philadelphia as well, but he said the best defensive midfielder is Andres Kubas. Now, the only thing with Andres Kubas is, like Julio Cascante, he loves a yellow card. I couldn't believe how quickly Cascante got his five yellows. Well, Andres Kubas, the same, 5 in 8 games. He missed the last game against New York. But that's what you're going to get from a player who loves to nip at the heels, who's quick to the ball. His range is incredible in terms of getting to the player in that central zone quickly because the Whitecaps do play a zonal defense. So he's not man-for-man marking the opponent's best player. For instance, he won't be all over Driussi. Oh, it just so happens that if they're in those positions, it's going to be a long day for your number 10, I think. But, you know, I'm sure that what you'll see, too, is that Driussi will probably look to try to avoid those areas where Andres Kubas is, just like most of the best players in the league do because of how good he is defensively.
Yeah, he last year, I think, was maybe a little under the radar, and this year I think maybe less so here for teams moving forward. You know, I think a lot of people were surprised when he came into the league and was able to own that space so hard.
Yeah, I think the referees have noticed him too as well. And you pick up a little bit of a reputation, right? And that you like to go in hard and put your stamp of authority on the game early. But he's also a pretty good sprayer of the ball. But, you know, in the last game when he wasn't there, Sebastian Berhalter came in. And what Danny had said ahead of that game is that, you know, the former Austin players, you know, maybe had one or two things that Andres Kubas didn't have, which is his range of passing, his ability to shoot. He had two free kicks that he took ahead of Ryan Gold in the last game. He smashed them both into the wall, but you know he's got that tonk of a right foot, Sebastian Berhalter. But I do think he'll make way for Andres Kubas in this game.
So you mentioned them sitting with a fairly deep defensive line. The back three of Veselinovic, who I haven't watched a ton of Vancouver this year, but from all accounts has been really good this year, then Tristan Blackman and Laborda in that back three. And then they play with we'll call them wingbacks for a moment, but maybe that's not an accurate description based on how they actually play. So from what I understand, one of the wingbacks will actually give width and be playing wide, and then oftentimes one of them will kind of float into midfield. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. Again, you're all over it there, aren't you? You know what you did, Landon. But, you know, the thing with him, and I say him because I'm talking about the guy who tends to take up the space down the flank a little bit more, which will be Ali Ahmed. He likes to go one-on-one. He likes to get isolated, where Alessandro Schopf on the other side will come inside a little bit more. And they're playing more of a diamond midfield this year. Schopf wasn't available in the last game. But that means that Ryan Gold's at the head of that spear, so to speak, in the foreign midfield. And it's getting him into more advanced positions. And like it or not, Vanni Sartini, who's often said that he hates wingers because he doesn't like to just get it wide and knock it in and then have a hopeful ball come in from wide areas, has been slowly warming to the fact that in those spaces, you can still create, if not just balls lumped into the box, at least 2v1 overloads where you can create chances that come in maybe along the deck, even from wide areas. And Sam Adekubi on that left side too has been playing in a more left forward position, the Canadian international. He's just finally getting up to full speed, but they do play a little lopsided on the strong side, and the other player will tuck in a little bit. And it's a very tactical setup the way Vanny likes to work his team. And when I say a deep line, I don't necessarily mean a bunkering team. And it is three in the back. It's not five. They don't drop the wing backs back. They keep them high. So there are spaces, and New York picked them out a little bit to get through them with Emil Forsberg down the left side and with Tolkien joining in that attack. But again, Vancouver will stay in their positions. They're not going to go chasing you to close down those spaces and then leave gaps centrally. They'll close the spaces centrally. So they'll accept the fact that they'll get their bodies in and around the center of the box and allow you to lump in crosses. And as you mentioned there before, too, is that Ranko Veselinovic leads the league in clearances and has been very steady. So they're happy to have the balls come in and him just knock them right back out.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've noticed that the possession number is not especially high for this Vancouver team throughout the season so far. Obviously, the Seattle game being the exception there.
But when you have one of the best goal differentials in the league, who cares how much of the ball you have, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, and if you're, you know, if you've got that control in the middle of the box, you know, it's not necessarily as big a problem. Austin as a team have been kind of trying to hold the ball a little bit less, it seems, working a little bit more on that transition offense. Is this something that Vanny like can be susceptible to at all? Or is this going to be one of those games where neither team really wants the ball?
We were joking about it ahead of the New York game, who is last in possession in Major League Soccer, and that it was going to be the Spider-Man meme of you. Who's going to take the ball? The referee's going to drop it at midfield and no one will go and get it, because both teams want to be so tight and compact defensively and then spring forward when they see the space in behind. The Whitecaps won't change the way they play home or away. In fact, they're almost more comfortable away from home because the onus isn't on them to attack. I feel against LA Galaxy that maybe they paid a little bit too much respect to LA in terms of the way that they sat back and allowed LA to dictate the tempo of that game. And although they didn't create that many clear-cut chances, the Galaxy, the crowd wasn't able to get into the game because the Whitecaps weren't threatening, really. Although they did have a couple of chances in the way that they wanted to, which was to get out on the counter. And Ryan White in particular had a ball over the top where he was one-on-one with the keeper and skewered it wide. And he had a couple of chances in that game. But in the end, the Galaxy quality did rip apart the Whitecap defense a little bit because they did stretch. So I think that we'll see that again, although against Toronto FC, they stormed from the front, defended really well. You know, Brian White does that all the time anyway, his high defensive pressure. And I could see against an Austin team that doesn't love playing with the ball at their feet in the back, sometimes under pressure, don't have answers for getting out of that pressure, that I think Vancouver could swarm and look to turn them over close to the Austin goal and try to score in that manner.
Yeah, I personally, I think one of the most interesting kind of aspects to this matchup, right, is the coaching mentality of Vanny versus Josh Wolf, where you know, Vanny Sartini invites the entire media group in and like shows them a presentation of this is exactly what we're going to do this year. And if Josh Wolf could say literally nothing to anyone about what's going to happen, he would prefer that.
That's really interesting. You know, we had the conversation with Josh last year and he was good about providing some insight, but there's no one like Vanny Sartini. And, and Josh knows that better than anyone because he's, I don't want to say a disciple, but you know, when Vanny Sartini was in the U.S. coaching development system, Josh came through some of that system underneath, not necessarily underneath Vanny, but, you know, under some tutelage of Vanny. And there's a lot of respect from a lot of coaches around MLS for Vanny because of that. But I think tactically, they are a little bit different in that respect. I think that Josh Wolf would rather his team play possession soccer, mm-hmm. you know, whether he feels that they necessarily have all the guns to be able to do that against a team like Vancouver that's very good defensively in Vancouver with that threat of breaking out on the counter if they do give it away. I think maybe he will be a little bit more cautious, let's say. But I'm looking forward to that tactical battle as well because we don't always know what Vanny's going to do on any given day, even though we know everything he wants to do at any given time based on some of that feedback he's provided. He's an absolute open book and he almost wants to give out the starting lineup so that everyone knows, maybe even to kind of say, well, here's what we're going to do and now try to beat us, you know?
Yeah. Talking about Josh Wolf wanting to play with the ball against the Galaxy this last week, they had the luxury of being up 2 goals pretty early, but actually did played a much more disciplined game than we've ever seen them before, where, okay, they have a chance to get forward and throw numbers forward and have chose not to on several occasions, which has never been the case with this team. So I'm kind of hoping that this is actually a page turning for this team where, okay, we can play a different game when we need to and know how to do it and do it competently, instead of it being a flash in the pan or an accident, like if that was the case last week.
Yeah. Well, you could probably say it was an accident if it was their first win or second win of the season. But the fact that it's 4 of the last 5, albeit, you know, you play the teams in front of you, just like the Whitecaps were criticized a little bit for their perfect 3-0 road record going into New York, where it was the worst teams in the conference that they beat away from home. Statistically, you'd say that a win in Seattle is always good. But again, they had 2 men up in that game. You know, you could say the same thing about Austin now, is it? They've beaten 4 of the last 5 opponents. And to beat the Galaxy, best in the West, as handily as they did, especially, as you say, getting the early goals, that changes the game state, obviously. When you're able to get that lead, it changes your whole mindset. And if anything, Greg Vanny, who's a team and a coach who likes to make sure that they don't give the ball away and are always thinking about that when they have the ball, they were the ones caught out in that situation. And 2 great goals, I have to say, from Austin, really well taken goals. And so they're in a bit of a different mindset, I think. They're very positive and confident. And I think you look at that 11, and it's a decent squad led by a player in particular, maybe who's not flourishing as he did a couple of years ago in Bruce, but obviously has that ability to to do that. Diego Rubio, he's had some good years in this league as well. So, you know, I look through that list of players that Boston has, that center, midfield, Pereira and Ring. You could say, notably, they're among the best defensive midfielders in the league in that 4-2-3-1 setup as well. If not on recent form over the last couple of seasons, you know, Pereira, a young player on the up and coming. I think that's a strong team. Stuber and goal. Very, very good. And surprisingly, Brandon Heinzeig, who I didn't necessarily rate over the top in terms of his ability with DC last year, solid pickup.
He's been very good this year.
Yeah. He has been, yeah.
He's looked a lot closer to his first couple of years, for sure.
Yeah. So I've always liked John Gallagher as well. I'm going on and on about your entire 11 there with Austin, but there's no reason to believe that this isn't a team that can be a lot better than it was last year in the start of this season.
So you mentioned before that Vinny Sartini had like a class favorite. Did you say who that was?
No, I was teasing it for you, but he has said it before. His teacher's pet is Brian White. And so when I talk about nobody being irreplaceable, obviously, the best player is Ryan Gold, their other designated player. You mentioned Andres Kubas in a more defensive role. But Brian White, non-DP, but as far as the coach is concerned, is a designated player, just not on a DP contract, and is the one who, without him, makes it so much more difficult for Vancouver to win. And obviously, it's goals in four straight games now for Brian White, and a beautiful one at his old home club, New York Red Bulls, last weekend. But it's what he does defensively from the front, how he leads the line, his selfless runs into the corners or off the ball that open up gaps for other players to flourish. It's that determination, that work ethic that spills onto the rest of his teammates, much like Ryan Gold, who is, as they say, the working man's DP and a player who works as hard tracking back to steal a ball in the zone just outside the 18 defensively as he does in the opposite 18-yard box. So those players work so well hand in glove that if either one is not on the field, it's tough. But it's Brian White, who's the teacher's pet, who leads the line and is really making this Whitecap team tick as a team.
Yeah, what a story that guy is. Just a few years back, like kind of a middle of the road MLS striker. Red Bulls sell him on for a few hundred thousand dollars in GAM. I think they probably felt pretty good about that transaction at the time.
Yeah,
it doesn't look so funny. Good now.
Ahead of the Red Bull game, it was like, oh, why did we give up him for Barlow? And, you know, I have to ask the same question, though. And not to be, okay, I knew in hindsight, but when the Whitecaps picked up Brian White, who was almost like a goal every two games type scorer in at every level he played, yes, not a ton at MLS, but for 500 grand, it was 400 plus one, and definitely the one kicked in because of his metrics. But I think they were underestimating how good they integrated his pressing ability. And that's something that Brian says that he picked up, obviously, from the Red Bull system. And it's worked a treat, especially under Vinny Sartini and the way that he's wanted to play. So you're right. Sean Davis, the former Red Bull player, who is his teammate, of course, said it was the best trade in MLS history within the league.
Yeah. I mean, he's just so Jersey. He's got so much of that Jersey soccer energy in him, you know? And so seeing that at the tip of that Vancouver attack always makes me a little bit nervous.
Yeah, I think for Austin, he's the player to watch. But it isn't, again, just about that one player, because obviously he needs the service, but he makes great runs. He led the league in headed goals last year as well with 8, and he's only 5'11", 6 feet tall. It's not as if he's a dominating presence there. So he'll cause problems in a bunch of different ways. But if he can stem the service, you know, it makes it a lot more difficult, obviously, for any team if their strikers aren't seeing the ball inside the dangerous areas. And he is a player, for the most part, that likes to score close to goal. I think it's just one goal in his entire MLS career that he scored from outside the box.
Yeah, well, Austin did a good job of... Actually, the last several games have done a decent job of kind of holding off transition attacks, which has been our Achilles heel since this team has existed. And so hopefully we can see Austin do that a bit more in this game. But who knows? Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. All right, well, lately I've been saying one team or another is going to say, oh no, during every Austin match. And I don't know which one it's going to be.
All right. Yeah,
well, I think for the Whitecaps, I'll let you go after this. I just mentioned that the fact that the Whitecaps lost their last home game and play 5 of 6 away from home, this game is massively important for them. This is the one in a sandwich of 6 total games away from home, having just played 4 in a row, by the way, at home before going away to Seattle and New York. This is the one that I think they feel we have to get points from this. So we'll see how that ends up maybe playing to their favor or against them. But when we came into this game, I mentioned this is a 50th anniversary game for the Whitecaps. A lot of alumni coming back from way back from the NASL team in 1974 through the years to where they are now. I didn't think, Austin, that's not, you know, the game that's going to be maybe the most glamorous or whatever until now. Maybe the hottest team in the league, right, for the last 5. So this is a real good Western Conference battle I'm looking forward to.
All right. Well, Paul Dolan, he's going to be on the call for MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. Paul, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, great to be with you guys. Anytime.
All right. We want to thank Paul Dolan one more time. We'd like to remind you to rate and review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Come find us on the internet. I'm at LVHarrow87 on Twitter. Mike is Future X Skeleton everywhere. And then we're at Moon Tower Soccer on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
And Patreon.
Again, the stuff is so cool. I'm so excited about these socks. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week where we will review the Vancouver Whitecaps match and we will do a preview of... Who are we playing?
FC Dallas.
Preview of the next... the next Copa Teos match against FC Dallas. Until then, I'm Lennon Cotton.
And I'm Mike Prignola.
We'll catch you next time. When no one is around.
Thank for nothing, you never.
La gente.
Oh my God.
I cannot get over Henry Wingo. I think his name is just so fun, and I am convinced, no one can tell me otherwise, I won't listen, that Austin FC went to Transfermarkt and sorted by nationality and contracts expiring in the summer and did Control F Wing, and that's how they found him. I'm convinced.
I think I saw Long Cow, friend of the show, say that I can't wait for the transfer rumor that we're going to sign a player named Striker Row.
Yeah. This is how we're finding these guys from now on. Control F. Okay, Google, soccer players.
Jonathan Centerbackman.